economic crisis. But people, I think, have to understand that the Olympics do not exist on a parallel realm to the economic crisis in Rio. They have been an aggravator of that very crisis because they've taken out infrastructure funds at a moment when people need them desperately, particularly around issues of health and education.
Dave, we want to thank you for being with us and look forward to talking to you in Rio. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine. His recent article is called The Last Dance on Heading to Olympic Rio, author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. He's host of Edge of Sports, and that does it for our show. We have two job openings, development manager and senior video producer. Check our website at democracynow.org for details. And a belated fond farewell to our producer, Amy Littlefield, whose commitment to social justice reporting is unparalleled. Amy, we wish you all the best in the future. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, and Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, Anthony Manzo, Karl Marxer, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Anna Ozbeck, and Matt Ely. We're on Facebook, Snapchat, Tumblr, and all the different social media platforms. Check it out. I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is our broadcast. Have a good weekend.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m. and coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Come over here to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KBOO was born. After 48 years, KBOO Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KBOO is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the man who pulled a gun at last month's Don't Shoot PDX protests gets indicted.
The Supreme Court rules Delaware's death penalty laws unconstitutional.
And a U.S. citizen who was denied entry into Palestine talks to KBOO.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 5th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
A Portland grand jury has charged the right-wing blogger Michael Strickland with 21 counts, 10 counts of unlawful use of a weapon, 10 counts of menacing, and 1 count of disorderly conduct. The incident that led to the 21 indictments happened on July 7th when Strickland pointed his gun at a Don't Shoot PDX protest. Strickland was arrested at the scene but was released a couple of weeks later after posting bail. Michael Strickland has been threatening and harassing activists, particularly trans women and women of color, for over a year. Police did not take action against Strickland, however, until his arrest on July 7th. Strickland is due back in court at the end of September.
A 19-year-old Oregonian who was facing a year in jail for a small amount of marijuana has had the charges against him dropped. Devontre Thomas is a Native American who grew up on the Warm Springs Reservation east of Mount Hood. He later attended Chamawa Indian School in Salem. The school is operated by the Bureau of Indian Education, a federal agency. Marijuana is legal in Oregon, and the federal government hasn't prosecuted a marijuana possession case in Oregon in 5 years. Despite this, in April, the U.S. attorney filed a one-count misdemeanor charge for possession of about 1 gram of marijuana. There was immediate public outcry. There was immediate
Portland is going to take a new approach to Portland is going to drag a new approach following Seattle's Drug 11 example. Portland is going to implement a law enforcement system diversion or lead program diversion to reduce the number of arrests related to drug addiction. Number of arrests under the lead program. Police officers will be encouraged to refer people to their lead caseworker rather than booking low-level drug offenders. A study done by the University of Washington found that the University of Seattle's lead program participants in Seattle less likely to be arrested in the first 6 months after enrolling. District Attorney Roger Nolan Underhill is hoping to get the program underway soon.
Fresco News is a news app currently being tested on 11 Fox News stations around the country. The app directs users to record photos and videos that may go on local television news that may go on the users whose footage goes on air receive $50. Footage goes on air. This new application was recently promoted in USA Today. Recently, the company Tegna hopes to take this technology to other media companies like Gamology. Other media professional photographer union rep Dave Twiddell is calling for Portland City Council to prohibit and divest from apps like Fresco and the companies that promote them. KBOO News Director Lisa Loving recently spoke with Twiddell after he led a presentation in Portland.
Let me tell you about Fresco. Here's how it works. You get an app, as you described. You can download it easily. Anybody can download the app. And then they've got a headquarters in New York where they scan the police scanners from the 11 cities that they operate in. And then they send assignments out to the general field of app holders. Telling them about, in one case, a carjacking, in another case, a bomb threat, and in the most egregious one that we showed at our town hall last night, of a man in the middle of a street beating up a woman.
All right. And Dave, in this issue, you're bringing up the issue of citizen journalism, but you're not really going after all citizen journalism. Can you talk a little bit about what you find more? What is the problem with citizen journalism under this app versus, say, for example, citizen journalism from KBOO Community Radio?
This program that does not have any training in it at all, and it just asks for random people to do something that I would definitely recommend citizen journalists to avoid completely, and that is to invest yourself into violent situations like somebody beating somebody up or like a carjacking or like a bomb scare. I think to entice people who are not experienced in that kind of law enforcement work to just go show up and try to get $50, it is really paparazzi journalism rather than citizen journalism.
All right. Here's my last question. So you had already spoken about how the Seattle City Council looked at this issue. What do you hope to have happen here in Portland?
We're hoping that the city commission, the county government, the city of Vancouver, and some of the other counties nearby, we hope they pass a similar resolution which calls out Tegna for their business model of deprofessionalizing their broadcast, and number two, ask for other institutions to divest themselves of Tegna stock. So we're going to, you know, try to make the public aware of these huge changes that are coming to local television, and then we're wanting to have a discussion we hope will become a national discussion about the future of TV. And I think all the stakeholders have something to say about it, including the advertisers.
All right, Dave Twiddell, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for calling.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Oregon Working Families Party will not be backing the re-election of Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Ron Wyden in November. Instead, the party will be putting up its own candidate, Shanti Lualan, a former longshore worker and now an attorney representing workers in wage theft and discrimination cases. OWFP chose to challenge Wyden because of his support for the fast-tracking of trade agreements like the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership. The party usually operates by endorsing or withholding endorsement of major party candidates, supporting those they consider to have the most labor-friendly records.
The city of Portland is considering a proposal to lease a 96,000-square-foot warehouse to turn into a shelter for houseless people. Meanwhile, Commissioners Dan Saltzman and Nick Fish are quibbling over the cost of the lease. The warehouse in northwest Portland, known as Terminal 1, is a surplus property currently owned by the Bureau of Environmental Service. The Portland Business Alliance on Wednesday tried to stall the process of converting the warehouse into a temporary shelter, despite their initial support. Pressure to find housing for the growing number of houseless people in Portland is mounting as the date for a sweep along the Springwater Corridor approaches in a few weeks.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Rising Up with Sonali at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 80 here in the Willamette Valley. In Hood River, they're looking forward to some more clear skies with a high of 83. Today in history, in 1861, the first federal income tax was implemented in the United States as a part of the Revenue Act of 1861. The 3% flat tax was levied as a way to help fund the Civil War.
Earlier this week, Delaware's highest court declared the state's death penalty law unconstitutional. Delaware's decision has refocused interest on Oregon's death penalty law, which remains on the books but has not been used in over 20 years. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke to Alice Lundell of the Oregon Justice Legal Center on Delaware's decision and any impact it may have in Oregon.
Alice, thank you for joining us today. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and give them a little bit of your background.
My name is Alice Lundell, and I am the Director of Communication for the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and our organization is part of a working group of seven organizations on the death penalty in Oregon that is looking into the issue of our death penalty.
Explain, if you will, what Delaware has decided relative to its capital punishment laws.
So what's happened this week in Delaware is that state Supreme Court has ruled that their death penalty law is unconstitutional because it violates people's right to a fair trial. And the reason why the Delaware Supreme Court took a look at this is because the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling fairly recently on a case out of Florida, and they invalidated a similar law in Florida. So basically, Delaware and Florida were allowing judges in death penalty cases to decide whether the factors that are necessary to support giving someone a death sentence were present, rather than insisting, as other states do, that only a jury can make the decision about whether those factors are present. What this does do, though, is it helps to support what is really a growing consensus across the country that the death penalty system doesn't work for us. What we have, to give you a picture of the situation across the country, right now we have 19 states and the District of Columbia who don't have the death penalty at all. And then we have another 12 states, including Oregon, that do technically have the death penalty, but are very low users of it. So you've got 12 states, including Oregon, that haven't carried out an execution in 10 or more years.
Alice, Governor Brown has indicated her strong opposition to the death penalty, but has not categorically ruled out the possibility that it may someday be used in Oregon. Does that in any way worry you?
Governor Brown has made her personal position on the death penalty clear. As you say, she is personally against the death penalty, but I think what she's doing is pretty smart. She's taking the time to really look into Oregon's death penalty. So she is taking the time to look at the issue and taking it seriously, the fact that as governor, she has a constitutional role within our death penalty system, which she has to respect, aside from any personal views that she might have. So it doesn't worry me that she is taking this time to look at the issue and that she's taking her role as governor seriously.
Thank you, Alice. This is Ray Bodwell for KBOO News.
In Chicago today, police released the dash cam video of the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Paul O'Neill on July 28th. The footage begins with the officers firing down a residential street at a fleeing vehicle driven by O'Neill. The vehicle was reportedly stolen. The video later includes the sounds of shots and the voices of officers, but does not show the fatal shooting itself. The officer who fired the fatal shot was wearing a body camera, but it was not turned on. O'Neill was apparently unarmed and was shot in the back after running from the scene of a car crash. The video then shows officers handcuffing the wounded youth, but not offering first aid or assistance of any kind. The head of the Chicago Police Oversight Agency called the video footage, quote, shocking and disturbing, end quote. Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson took quick action after the shooting, stripping three officers of their police powers. Superintendent Johnson was appointed by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel in response to a public outcry over other police shootings. Johnson later said that it appeared the three officers had violated departmental policies and issued an unusual department-wide memo saying that the shooting left him with more questions than answers.
Two more incidents of black people killed by police are galvanizing the movement for accountability in law enforcement this week. Free Speech Radio News' Nell Abram has more.
Two more incidents of black people killed by police are galvanizing the movement for accountability in law enforcement this week. In Chicago, the Independent Police Review Authority released video Friday of the events that led to the shooting death of an unarmed black youth late last week. Multiple officers opened fire as Paul O'Neill crashed a stolen vehicle. Despite body-worn and dash cam video recorded during the incident, the fatal shot was not captured, but the 18-year-old ran from the car and was shot in the back as he tried to flee. The video was made public just days after Baltimore police killed a young black mother, Corinne Gaines, while she was holed up in her apartment with her 5-year-old son. An officer shot Gaines after an hours-long armed standoff, during which she posted to Facebook, saying they needed to control negotiations. Law enforcement asked Facebook moderators to suspend her account, and the social media platform complied. Police admit they fired first, striking the woman, who then returned fire. The child was also hurt, but is expected to recover. Family members want to know why the standoff ended in police use of lethal force. Shannon Gaines, Corinne's aunt, told WBAL-TV that her niece was not an active threat.
Why would they kill her over standing her ground in her own home? She wasn't shooting at them. She wasn't openly firing on the police officers. She was sitting in the floor of her apartment.
Both cases add to a string of police killings caught on video in recent months. The rapid spread of information on social media has sparked widespread calls for police accountability and even abolition. Earlier this week, protesters calling for changes in law enforcement leadership encamped in Los Angeles and Chicago were joined in New York City with calls for the mayor to fire embattled New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton. Just one day later, Bratton announced his pending resignation, though both he and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio insisted the timing was coincidental.
110% has nothing to do with this.
Bratton is an architect of so-called broken windows law enforcement, in which police aggressively pursue disorderly conduct on the theory that there is a trickle-up effect on major crimes. Critics say the model, now used in cities across the country, is inherently biased and exacerbates tension between officers and the communities they're sworn to serve. Joel Northam is one of the organizers of a New York coalition of police abolitionists who are occupying a park across from City Hall.
It's a racist mechanism of social control. They know it, we know it. It's basically, Frederick Douglass said it back in 1845 when he said, they whipped the slaves for the slightest offenders to discourage them from committing larger ones. This is exactly what we're seeing the police do with broken windows.
Two police officers were convicted this week on charges related to the shootings of unarmed citizens. In Baltimore, an officer was found guilty of assault in the non-fatal shooting of a 46-year-old burglary suspect. And in Portsmouth, Virginia, another officer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in the shooting of a black teen accused of shoplifting.
A 90-year-old activist in Argentina faces arrest for her refusal to cooperate with corruption investigation. Ebe de Bonafini is the president of the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, a world-renowned group of mothers and grandmothers of those who were killed by Argentina's military dictatorship from 1976 through 1983. Many of the victims were kidnapped and never seen again, becoming known as the Desaparecidos, or the Disappeared Ones. The Madres have marched around the plaza next to the seat of national government every week for over 30 years. The Madres have recently become controversial in Argentina, if not globally, because of their hard left politics and strong ties to the former regime of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. They were awarded millions under Kirchner to build schools, hospitals, and other facilities for the poor. However, the program was halted abruptly in 2011, and a recent investigation has targeted the group to find out what happened to those funds. Bonafini is not being personally targeted for prosecution, but was called to testify and repeatedly refused, citing her thorough distrust in Argentina's police and judicial system. At the weekly march around the Plaza de Mayo yesterday, Bonafini was defiant and repeated her criticisms of the conservative government of current President Mauricio Macri. "We're going to face this with the same courage as our children," she said.
Activists from around the world are converging on Montreal, Canada next week for the World Social Forum. About 20,000 people are expected at the forum, where activists gather to plan, strategize, and network. But dozens of featured speakers have been denied visas by the Canadian government. Organizers are petitioning Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to allow the activists to enter for the social forum. More information can be found on the website fsm2016.com.
A delegation of U.S. citizens was recently denied entry into Israel and Palestine by the Israeli government. Most of the members of the delegation were people of color and several were Muslims. They report that Israeli authorities interrogated them about their religious beliefs and loudly called them, quote, terrorists in front of hundreds of passengers at the airport. The only reason given by Israeli authorities for calling the visitors terrorists was that they were part of a delegation sponsored by the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which calls for equal rights for Palestinians. The State Department did not give any official statement as to why the members of the delegation were denied entry or assistance by the Consulate General. Rama Kudemi was one of those who was denied entry. She spoke with KABU about her experience.
Rama, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about the delegation.
The delegation was going to observe how Palestinians are treated, living under military occupation, facing apartheid policies, resisting ethnic cleansing, by the Israeli government, and it was made up of different activists from different struggles in the United States, including people who work on immigrant rights issues, people who are part of the movement for Black Lives, so a lot of indigenous activists as well, and various people of color. And it was, you know, an opportunity to really make links between struggles against racism here in the United States, as well as against racism in Palestine.
What was your experience when you tried to cross into the Palestinian territories?
I was interrogated for 2 hours, a lot of questions about why I was coming. They asked me a lot about my political ideas, about my political activism, a lot about my work with the U.S. campaign. When I told her I was coming to, you know, visit places like Tel Aviv, she gestured to the way I was dressed. I wear a headscarf, and she said, "You want me to believe that someone like you wants to go to Tel Aviv and go to the beaches?" So a lot of profiling was definitely happening based on the fact that I was visibly Muslim. And then at the very end of the interrogation, she accused me of being a terrorist and that I was coming to do bombings and that this was something she was going to relay back to the U.S. government. She just made that up. She definitely profiled me and was basing it on a stereotypes of me as a Muslim. I must have tendencies to commit terrorism, and that is all that is based on. I mean, she had Googled me. Definitely. So if they, you know, if you look through my Google, I obviously have committed no crimes and have never in my life preached anything that would come near their definition of terrorism. It was just based on me being Muslim and my activism for Palestinian rights.
Well, KBOO listeners who heard the Flashpoints interview with Rania Khalik on Tuesday would have heard her say that no matter who wins the election in November, it will be disastrous for Palestinians. Is that your opinion as well? And do you think there are political avenues that people can take in order to achieve justice for Palestinians, given the two political candidates that have been chosen by the major parties?
I think we need to continue building the grassroots efforts in support of Palestinian rights. I think people of conscience all across the globe have many opportunities that they can take locally to support Palestinian rights on a global level. When we're talking about BDS campaigns, so the very basic choices you make about which consumer products you buy. So when we're talking, you know, so don't buy HP products. Don't buy SodaStream. When you're thinking about campaigns locally, think about campaigns that target companies like G4S, which are complicit both in the denial of rights to Palestinian political prisoners, but also very much complicit in the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration here in the United States. And so it's very important that no matter what is happening on the policy level, yes, we are very far from making major changes on the policy level, and neither the Democrats or the Republicans, you know, there are some openings here and there, but still nothing that will lead to a massive change where the United States is actually sanctioning Israel and withholding major military aid. But we need to continue building the grassroots so that people can, you know, figure out how you engage locally to support Palestinian rights. And so I urge people to go to websites like our website and theoccupation.org to plug into these campaigns.
Well, thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Rama Kudemi. She is the director of grassroots organizing with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Their website, endtheoccupation.org. She was recently denied entry into the Palestinian territories by Israeli authorities as she was part of a delegation from the United States. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Longshanks, Ray Bodwell, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News for their reporting. And our engineer tonight is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey speaks with Gabrielle Hayden about a class she's teaching for Portland Underground Graduate School. It's called Elegizing Black Lives. It looks at how African-American poets have elegized victims of lynching and state violence. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Paul Lumley of the Columbia Intertribal Fish Commission. They'll talk about why the struggle to prevent the Pacific Northwest from becoming an export hub for fossil fuels is of particular urgency to all the tribes in the Northwest. And at 11 on Health Watch, Ellen Goldsmith speaks with Dr. Peter Bongiomo, director of Inner Source Health and author of a number of books on the naturopathic approach to treating depression and anxiety. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Have a great weekend, and stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Rising Up with Sonali. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.